This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Have you ever wondered, are we as good as what we say we are when it comes to safety? That's what I'm going to talk about in today's episode. Let's jump into the intro and we'll tell you some more about it. Let's go.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by RiskBlue. What's up, people? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is a YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit subscribe, hit the bell and all of those magical algorithm buttons. My name's James McPherson, I'm your host for today's episode. I'm also the MD of the consulting company that sits behind Rebranding Safety called Risk Fluent Limited. So have you ever wondered, are we as good as what we say we are? I mean, I've mentioned this a lot on the podcast. We're nowhere near as good as what we think we are. But my argument has always been, we're still killing people. Every single year we're killing people and no one seems to be that bothered about it. No one seems to be really pushing anything. No one seems to be really doing anything. We just seem to be bickering and not actually having any impact on the annual rates that come out every year that has plateaued for the last decade. And that's just fatality rates, right? If we were to push that to one side and look at the health rates and look at construction dust, if we were to look at occupational cancers, occupational asthmas, we were to look at mental health and stress, these figures are scary, people. They are scary. And that's always been my argument, right? We're nowhere near as good as what we think we are. We seem to be just have this cognitive dissonance when we look at the HSC annual certificates, right? But there's this guy on LinkedIn that is just everywhere, like in comments being like, what about this, what about this, and plows loads of certificates in. And he pretty much says, we're not as good as what we think we are, but we're worse. And he's got a statement that basically says the HSE stats are nowhere near reality. So we had to get him on, we had to talk about this. So today we're going to talk about how he came to that realization, kind of what that felt like and where he gets his information from. We'll talk about that as well. And then hopefully in the future, we're going to get, I won't say what campaign it is because we'll talk about it in the episode, but we're going to try and get somebody from that organization that collects that data to come on and talk about the podcast so we can find out a little bit more about that as well. But today's guest is a guy, if you're on LinkedIn, that you will know his name. His name is Vincent Butler. Let's jump into the episode and talk to Vincent. Right. Vince, welcome to the podcast, mate.
Oh, thanks, James. Thanks for inviting me on.
That's all right. I thought there was a bit of a delay there then, but I'm hoping my internet's going to hold out. How are you good today? You're all good?
Let me just check. Well, generally, yes, but I've got some issues going on with a bit of a mechanical problem in my right knee. I'm going to hospital to have it replaced with a half a new knee on the 27th of September up in Oxford. Right. So that'll keep me off the road and keep me from my pastimes for a few months.
Yeah.
But once it's done, I think that should set me off for the rest of my life. And we'll get back to my golf and doing some active things and having a good time.
Nice. When I worked in packaging, one of our customers made the, like, I don't know, titanium bits that went on knee.
Oh, wow.
So we had to like keep all of the products like clinically clean. It was a
nightmare. Yeah.
We shouldn't have really took that contract on. We were not a like it was kind of food safe level standards.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we weren't really capable of doing that though.
Yeah.
We were just a rag 'em and tag 'em kind of packaging company.
If I get one of those replacement knees, James, I'll be pretty comfortable. It'll be a good one.
No, it's the packaging I'd worry about, not the product. do you want to introduce yourself, Vince, in case you don't know who you are?
So I'm a County Durham person, born and brought up there on the East Durham coast. I went into the coal industry with the National Coal Board at age 16, straight out of school on one of the mining craft apprenticeship schemes. Did 20 years of deep mining out under the North Sea, about a half mile down, 3, 4, 5 miles out under the sea. 16 of those 20 years I worked actually at the coalface, doing all the machine work and coalface work. And then I became a shot firer, then a deputy, then an overman. And then I moved into safety in the coal mines in around 1990. And then I was appointed as a statutory under manager from 1990 till I finished my career in 1994. So it's fairly unusual to come all the way through the ranks into a reasonably senior management position from an apprentice boy starting at 16. Had a fantastic grounding and basis in engineering, mechanical, electrical, mining, surveying, a bit of law, and also in the development through to being a supervisory and managerial person, the management training activity, what the National Coal Board and British Coal did, was exceptionally good. So that wonderful grounding and broad base of, you know, skills, abilities and activities and techniques in work and management. Then when all the coal mines closed in the early to mid-90s, British Coal paid for me and I decided to go into safety as a second career in my mid-30s. I went off and did, I'd already done the NEBOSH certificate in around 1991 or two. And then in 1994, I went off and did the NEBOSH diploma. I did the whole lot in one sitting. British Coal paid for all that, so I'm a lucky guy. I kind of had 6 months out of work still being paid. That gave me to study full time and get stuck into that. And I was one of the few who kind of passed through that process at NEBOSH diploma level at the time. And British Coal found me the job opportunity to come to work with Southern Electric Contracting. So I moved my family from the Durham area around Sunderland and Tynemweir down into Reading. And I've been here since 1994. So I've done 20 years with Scottish and Southern Energy, their contracting division and the main business, in construction, in utilities, in the military, on railways. I mean, a fantastic broad range. But just think about, if an organisation needs electricity, we probably need to send electricians there so that, you know, that breadth of anything and everything came in. And since 2014, I've been a freelance, self-employed health and safety consultant person working for a range and a number of clients in construction, in the space and robotics sector. And I've just started to work with another client back into high voltage electricity utility type of work. I was up in London on Friday doing a site visit to help plan a piece of work to put some high voltage cables in right outside Pentonville Prison. So we're going to dig a very big hole right outside the prison wall, which should be interesting to see what kind of reaction that gets. And then lead through 600-700 meters of public roadway into a new construction site that's being done fairly near King's Cross Station. So a bit of work up in the city. I've done a fair amount of things where I've been kind of, you know, first past the post type of thing. The podium we use for low height access. I'm fairly sure I had the very first prototype of that product made in the early 2000s after the death of a colleague. The two-part gloves that the people use for live electrical work to prevent them from arc burn, I was involved in that. Fall arrest safety harnesses onto contracting linesmen working on wood poles many, many years before the work at height regulations, first past the post with things like that. And then the creation and development of risk and safety management systems for peripatetic and outdoor workers. So think of 2,500 electrical craftsmen and tradies working in 1,000 different workplaces day after day after day, you know, basically pulling the places apart, all the asbestos issues, work at height access, and elevating the skill level in safety. Did some work, did some activity around that. Probably nobody had done before. So, you know, all of the kind of basis of learning things around work and danger and risk and hazard and managing around that has put that great grounding in. So can figure out most things. And also working in the mine, I was involved in running and operating the occupational hygiene team. So, you know, airborne dusts and temperatures and humidities, ground dust, ventilation management systems and things. So that great grounding, I think, has been a wonderful asset to work in a number of industries for a number of clients, doing fairly successful things. I've had a few activities I've done which have been an absolute disaster. Who hasn't? And caused a fair amount, you know, significant issue for you know, clients and myself. But we've kind of got past that one and moved on. But generally speaking, a happy, contented, successful work life that I've usually been kind of over the moon to go to work. I've generally loved my work for all the nearly 50 years I've been doing it and still do so.
Wow. So you don't really know much about safety at all, really, then, do you?
Well, I think I know maybe 7%. No, really, James, you know, for I have a working knowledge of lots of things. I have an expertise of a couple of them things, but I know who to go to if I get stuck. There's some additional expertise, you know, in the safety and health community that can provide that kind of additional support and the rest of it. Most of the time I've done the things I've done, I can reasonably easily recognize I am at the end of my competency here. This is not what I do. But I know people who have got the competency to come and add support to the team. You know, occupational hygiene, occupational health, environmental health, ergonomists, anthropometrists, you know, org psychs and things like that. So, you know, never been scared to show up and say, sorry, I can't do that. That's you know, beyond my capability, my competency, my understanding. Can we suggest that we could get some further help here? And that was one of the good things about working in the mining industry. There were a big group of people who had those expertises you could call on.
So you popped into my world, I suppose, via LinkedIn predominantly. But actually the first time was back in my, I don't know, let's just say back a couple of years ago, where I was on the IOS Future Leaders steering committee before it came a whatever it is now, which is not a steering committee in my opinion. But and we had a lovely little group. I'm really trying to push IOS a little bit further than we were. A lot of, I wouldn't say all of us on the group, but definitely there's a couple that I talked to a lot that were a bit disenfranchised by IOS and so on. So we joined this. Well, a lot of people were saying, oh, you should go. And we went on there. And anyway, long story short, it was mid COVID. So we didn't really have the impact that we wanted to. It was with IOS. So we didn't really have the impact that we wanted to. And then we did a digital conference.
Yeah. I attended that. Yeah.
And you came to that. And, and your comments were like, really in depth and quite challenging to the profession, to IOS, and to go through. So I kind of connected with you off the back of that and just kept an eye really on what you're doing. And then that just seemed to pop up everywhere. You're constantly, in a way, Vince, it was kind of like you were desperately trying to kind of hold us account and maybe tell us that we're not as good as we think we are.
Yes, that's a reasonable summary, James. Yeah, a reasonable summary.
So where does that come from, Vince? That kind of need?
I think my whole life, James. You know, there always has to be the one person that's got a bit of bravery and a bit of knowledge that, like, kind of, you know, tugs the sleeve of the bosses and the owners and the chiefs and say, you know, you've got all these wonderful stories and all these wonderful things, but what about that over there?
Mm.
Yeah. And that's always been, I don't know why I'm like that. And I've done things around helping other people, I think, in almost all my living memory. So I've done charitable types of things from being a boy, from being a schoolboy, 11 years of age.
Yeah.
You know, I've done St. John Ambulance. We did elite first aid at work. You know, dealt with many, many things. I've been a trade union person for all 48 years of my working life, and still am, you know, an enthusiastic and passionate trade union person. I've got to see as well, through most of my career, it's actually been quite destructive.
Mm.
So I probably should have been more senior than I was, particularly in the energy industry. I live with that. I've still done okay. I'm still, you know, reasonably well off in the big scheme of things. However, you know, when the chief executive officer gets you by your jacket lapels, yes, and puts you up against the wall and say you need to keep quiet, are you in the right place or are you in the wrong place? Yes.
Mm.
It's been quite uncomfortable, but yes, the evidence-based facts are something here isn't right and nobody's asking, nobody's pointing, nobody's saying, and I've always done something like that.
Mm.
So I ain't going to change now, and I'll keep pointing things out. And, you know, when I finish full-time work, it gives you a bit of time to actually try to read and learn and educate and ask and question, you know, why are things the way they are? So I hook onto maybe 8 or 10 economists, you know, who are suggesting why the world is the way it is. Maybe 3 or 4 kind of contemporary philosophers, you know, who've written copious amounts of books, all evidence-based facts, all good information, the rest of it. And then the things that you thought were happening, there's the evidence to kind of back up what you thought.
Yeah.
And when you're working, you know, on a busy person and you're, you know, getting into kind of senior management positions, you're putting your 50, 60, 70 hours a week in and running around the country and the rest of it, you ain't got the time to swallow and take in and understand and work your way through these kind of things. And the world's not a very pleasant place for most of the people on it, James. And the Hazards campaign is one bit of information. I think I came across them in a union conference, probably in the 1990s.
Oh, right, wow.
I mean, I could be mistaken there. I'm flicking back. We went to a university somewhere on a campus in the summertime, and the safety conference was delivered in a different style to anything I'd ever been to before. And I'm pretty sure it was the Hazards campaign people, but didn't particularly appreciate the significance of what they were trying to tell us at the time, even though I'm a trade union person, a trade union safety rep, and various things like that.
Mm.
And we kind of lead on to the last few years. And there's a person who's a senior. I don't know whether Hilda Palmer is the leading person in Hazards campaign. She's certainly kind of one of the leading lights and the public-facing person. And then there has to be some credibility and some sense and some evidence-based fact around some of the things which the Hazards campaign are reporting. Hilda was selected in 2020 by SHP as the most influential health and safety person of the year. Now, I would expect that there's been a bit of governance, a bit of competence, a bit of fact-finding gone through by an organisation like SHP Online to look at the bona fides of the information which has been shared in order to make such an award, you know, one of the prestigious awards in health and safety almost in the world. So I would kind of hang my hat on, and I think most other people probably should as well, on the information that the Hazards Campaign have shared, and usually just before the Workers' Memorial Day every year on the 28th of April, whatever day that falls on, there's an updated set of facts, figures, a resource pack, some information, the justification of why they've said the numbers they've said, comparison with what our regulators are saying, and the numbers and the facts and the figures are off the scale different. So in the year in question, I think it's 2020-21, HSE reported 142 deaths at work, by and for as a result of work activity. So they would have been reported, I'd imagine, under the RIDOR regulations. And the Hazards Campaign people reported 1,319. Now, that's not some kind of rounding up or down error, is it? I mean, you know, you're talking about like just about 10 times more. People have lost their lives at work, and then Hazards Campaign go on to see it. Where have we got these numbers from? And some of them are, you know, factual information reported to other bodies other than the HSE, and some of them are estimates based on kind of credible numbers from other organisations, other bodies, charitable organisations like Mind and things like that. And then you start to look into these things and find the same types of numbers, you know, give or take 4 or 5%, are being reported from organisations at different ends of the spectrum with different levels of agendas, and the same types of numbers and credibility of those numbers and the evidence behind those numbers are the same. And you'd be talking about something like Hazards Campaign and the union movement on one end and HR Magazine on the other end.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the numbers broadly for suicide, attributable or caused by the effects of something to do with work.
Yeah.
Hazards Campaign report 599 people, which is quite an exact number. The HR Magazine was reporting around 650. So broadly, the numbers are about the same. So if they were wrong by 20% up or down, or 30% up or down, the issue would be is something is very, very wrong.
Mm.
The point would be is when you start to make the point about the something very, very wrong, and then you perhaps state where the information came from, then the argument from a counter person would be, oh, are there only estimates?
Mm.
Yeah, but there's some credibility, a bit of research, asking some questions, proving things, and a bit of governance have gone on. So when something is released to the rest of the world, you would hope that the organizations releasing it have done a bit of governance and a bit of research and a bit of checking, and they can cover off those awkward questions. And that's why I think this information is trustworthy, is credible, and we should be taking a lot more notice of it than we are.
And to put this, just as you were talking, I thought we'd better get the latest update up, and we can just kind of put into context the sheer difference. And I'll link this in the show notes for people. But the whole story, work-related injury, illness and deaths, March 2022 update. Estimates say that the work kills 169 people, get this, a day in Britain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which we estimate, the HSE records less than that a year.
Yeah.
which is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
Seven people killed per hour. The UNILO estimates worldwide work kills more than war every year. Worldwide work kills minimum of 2.9 million people every year. And this is actually one of my favorite quotes. Jukka Takala, I hope I'm saying that right, of the ILO, said, if terrorism took such a toll, just imagine what would be said and done. Yeah. And do you know what that gets me on this whole thing, Vince, right? If you, even if you disregarded what the Hazard campaign talk about because they're estimates, right? Even if you went, it's nothing. The average from the HSE recorded deaths is still like 130 to 140 a year on average over the last decade, more than a decade, which hasn't changed. If you were to divide that by the amount of working, that's like one a week or something like that. Like, it's still a massive amount. Probably more than one a week. My maths is terrible. But it's still a huge amount of deaths a week. So if you had that because of gun violence, terrorism, knife violence, drugs, well, you probably do have it for drugs and no one talks about it. It would be on the news. But
Of course.
And yet the Hazard campaign say it's even worse than that. And I also just wanted to cover a couple of other things. Sorry, just quickly. So there's a slide on here. Says a whole story much greater than the HSE estimates and records. Nine times as many deaths caused by works, and nine times, which is at least 1,319. Four times as many work-related illness deaths, approximately 60,000. The estimate that the number of people made ill by work is approximately five times greater than the HSE estimate, at least 6 million. And they estimate between 15,000 and 20,000 reported deaths of workers from COVID-19 based on 12% of deaths. And then lastly, because you mentioned stress and mental health, they also have a slide on here. They cover it under work-related ill health.
Yeah.
Work-related stress, depression, or anxiety, 2,300,000.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. So, in context with that little section about quoting what's on the Hazards campaign resource that was out for the 2022 Workers' Memorial Day. So some of the things you know, I kind of read and look at and figure out and think when we mention in the media, in books, in the press, in, you know, the dreadful scenes that we see with starving kids in various parts of the world and the killers of human beings through history, right the way back into antiquity, from cave drawings and Babylonia and the historians and archaeology people have dug things up and we figured this out, and then we've got written history, recorded history, all the way through the millennia, the centuries, the decades and the years. Yeah.
Yeah.
We usually list war, famine, disease, disaster, genocides in the context of the mass killers of human beings on Earth in our history. One word that's never covered in there, and if we did some scholarly research and really looked at this properly, is work. Yes? So when you look at them numbers, at least 2.9 million people are killed on Earth every year by, for, and because of the work they did. And it doesn't appear in that context. I mean, why might that be, James? Why is that not, yes, a sixth mass killer of human beings added to the end of the rest of them? So, you know,
the skeptic in me is just because it's a direct competition with the profits of the economy. That's
yes. Well, I know it's not the end of the podcast, but I rest my case, my love. Yes.
Thank you very much.
But I think very seriously that is the point, yes, of all of the things I try to do. Yes. And don't get me wrong, you know, anybody out there that might be listening to this who's screaming at the screen now, what's he on about? There's nothing wrong with profit, but not at any cost. Yes.
So this is this is interesting. This is stumbling across something that we hadn't really planned to talk about, Vincent, but I would be really interested to get your thoughts on it. There is another podcast that I listen to quite a lot called the World of Work podcast. Probably one of my favorite podcasts. And I've recently been invited on it, which is a massive win for me.
Good man.
Really excited about going on there. And we're going to get one of the hosts on there, a lady called Jane, going to come on here as well. And the reason I wanted to get her on is because a long time ago, she said something that really stuck in my head and probably set me down a bit of a rabbit hole, of which I think list watching your comments and you really introduced me into the Hazard campaign has aided in that rabbit hole, probably getting deeper. But she said something that really stuck with me, in that she said, not everything should be a business case, because not everything is beneficial essentially to the profit of the organization. That's the point of what a business case is. It's profitable to the business if we do this. And safety have been trying to do that for a long time, right? You know, if you want to sell safety, you've got to show them how it's beneficial to the company. NCRQ qualification is one of the newer ones.
Yeah.
I did their diploma. Excuse me. And there's a whole assessment on that, creating a business case. And she said, you're supposed to have moral cases. So basically there are some things, and I would stick safety in there, safety, environment, sustainability, corporate social responsibility, like that they're not meant to be profitable for the company. And if we stop trying to make them profitable for a company and start having conversations around a moral case, and stop trying to just go, oh, no one's listening to the moral case. Well, I think safety might be a little bit better off if we stop trying to bullshit everybody to say safety is good for the business. There is no evidence to say that safety is just good business, or anything like that. And I just think, should we not talk about the moral side of it a lot more? I recently presented to a group of small businesses in like a local networking thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm often, because of we have the company, and then our kind of purpose is rebranding safety. So the podcast is like a campaign for us. And so normally when we do a keynote or something, it's called Why and How to Rebrand Safety, right? And one of the slides we have on there, we have two slides. We have one, there's a couple of Facebook and social media screenshots of how people talk about safety. And they're not nice comments. They're like, you know, fuck health and safety and all of that stuff. It's safety.
Waste of time, waste of money, waste of effort, waste of anything. Just costs us loads of money and stops us getting on.
You got it, right? Yeah. So that's the first slide I put on, one of the first slides. The next slide is the names of all the people that died in a previous year, according to the HSE, on one slide.
Yeah.
And the reason I do that is because I want you to see their names. I want you to see they are people. They're not numbered, not 127 people. I want you to see their name. And I normally pick out a couple. I learn the story and I say, well, let's look at these two over here. So last year, for example, you had a father and son. You'll see the son was, if I remember rightly, 19. The father was, I think, in his 50s, if I remember rightly. They went on a construction site owned by the father. They went up a construction lift. The lift failed, it failed, and they both died. Father and son died together. So not only did the wife lose her husband, she lost her son as well. That's just one example. And I had a raft of people come over at this meeting saying, I've never had it put to me like that before. One woman came over. They were like, she felt uncomfortable. I'm like, that's the point. I'm not here telling you do safety because it's good for your business, because sometimes it will be. And over the long run, if you're not getting sued and your premiums come down, then yes, it is. But sometimes it's slower, it's annoying, it might cost you a little bit more, you've got to think about things. And sometimes it might mean you have to say, no, we can't do that job, or no, we're going to be late to do a deadline. So for me to say it's business case, it's good for business, would be a direct lie. Elon Musk said in an interview on the Joe Rogan podcast that everybody thinks that AI is going to replace the shop floor worker, when actually he thinks it'll more likely to replace the decision makers in a business, like the managers or the board members, for example. RiskFluent and Protex AI don't actually think that's the case, though. We think that AI is exactly what safety managers and senior leaders need to help take our organisations to the next evolution. We think that whilst we're doing what we do, AI can get cracking, gathering data, spotting trends and finding all those hidden bits of data that we can't see, and we can use that then to inform us to make better decisions. If this is something you're interested in, then you totally need to keep an eye out on what Protex AI are doing. At the moment, they're running a webinar series, and the first webinar in that series is called AI versus the EHS Manager. If you want to find out more information or sign up to that webinar, then you should go to their website, which is in the description below. That was a very big question. Yeah. Ultimately, like, yeah. I'd be interested on your opinion on how safety has for so long tried to align ourselves with being solely for the benefit of the company.
Yeah. Well, I would have a fair amount of evidence and some facts to back it up. That in a particular part of industry sector, we went at planning and controlling work and put a massive amount of effort into that. And the reason behind it was performance, output, profitability, etc. The spin-off from putting a lot of effort, time and resources into planning and controlling work properly equaled a fantastic safety story.
Right.
Yes. So we stopped hurting people and killing people and maiming people and doing lots of damage to customers and clients' assets and things like that.
Yeah.
So my history of safety work, and one of the reasons why I went about things along with the directors in a particular way, is because of my work background in the mines.
Right.
You know, figuring things out that were awkward, stupid, uncomfortable, dangerous, difficult, and you know, hurt and maimed people. And taking that kind of skill set over into a different industry and then trying to share with them, you know, to kind of critically appraise every time we were unable to carry out physical work because we had the wrong keys, we didn't have somewhere to park, we had the wrong access equipment, we stopped off at the wholesaler and picked the wrong items up to take to the client, we got the wrong address. It's just something kind of silly. And all the time you've lost control and your plan hasn't worked, the working person starts taking risks.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and fall off the ladder or get electrocuted or damage some of the customer's assets or close the customer's plant down and things like that. So it was around business performance, and we managed to get a safety spin off from it.
Mm.
But when you've talked about, James, about listing the names of people on a slide, one of the hidden parts, which I think the Hazards campaign are trying to highlight and others, is this is UK numbers, not the world numbers, just UK numbers. For every one of them people who died because of a work accident, fell off a ladder, got run over by the fork truck, a lifting tackle collapsed, they were electrocuted, there was some, you know, somebody locked them in an oven and cooked them, you know, them awful, dreadful, dramatic stories. For every one of them, there's another 100, yes? 100-to-1 ratio who die because of the work they did, but not at work. No drama, no ambulance, no investigation, no prosecution, no increase in insurance premiums, or if there are, it's a peppercorn amount. The people who die from occupational diseases, yes, the cancers and the silicosis and the pneumoconiosis and the asbestosis and all these kind and the work-related cancers and carcinogens.
Yeah,
and here's a phenomena that's in your bullets around the silicosis tsunami that's coming our way. Now, in 1954, yes, my father, when he started work as a boy in the coal mines, learned about silica dust and silicosis. In 1974, when I started work in the mine, I learned about silica dust and silicosis. If we went to a construction site tomorrow from a mid-level construction company, stopped a couple of guys using a disc cutter, and asked them, tell me about silica dust and silicosis, I would think the answer we would struggle to get.
Yep.
So incredible, reasonable, I understand where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. So we have a cohort of people who are kind of my age and older, who've had silicosis, have died or are dying from the mining, construction, stonework, quarrying, those kinds of industries. Yeah. So we've more or less in them industries got this under control to a decent extent, and the reports are reducing. And that's been replaced by construction-related silicosis. So the introduction of disc cutters in the early 1990s, because of a technical change in the rules and the laws around reinstating the highway after you've cut it open to put a cable or a pipe or something inside, specified the use of road saws instead of we would use the old pneumatic jackhammers, you know, like a road breaker pick. So yeah. The road breaker pick was a dangerous piece of kit because of noise and vibration and shards and things like that. But what it didn't produce was the volumes and levels of respirable crystalline silica, which, you know, all of us have seen. So our colleagues in the British Occupational Hygiene Society, you know, a trustworthy, credible, professional, you know, highly qualified, you know, fairly well regulated, highly regulated, a part of a contribution to business, have done their report recently to the All-Party Parliamentary Committee on Respiratory Health. 2.2 million people in the UK from the construction industry at significant risk of silicosis. So this is from the early 90s to today, yes? And think about the death rate when it spikes hasn't arrived yet, the kind of 30, 35 years of latent time between breathing the dusts and getting ill and dying from it. That hasn't reached us yet. That's still to come. And that's after the cost regulations, their original form came along in the late 80s, early 90s. So disc cutters and those type of machines came along at around about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
How have we managed this, James? How could this possibly have happened?
It blows my mind that some... I mean, you're throwing out dates there where I'm either a kid or wasn't even born, and yet when silicosis, what a crystalline silica, was kind of coming into my knowledge, it was kind of communicated, I wouldn't say overtly, but definitely kind of covertly communicated, kind of like a new risk. Risk. We didn't know about crystalline silica before now. Mm-hmm. This is brand new information.
Yeah. Well, but you know, I rest my case. And here's the point. We've known about this for at least 100 years.
Yeah.
From science as it was at the time. I've seen some resource pop in to my LinkedIn feed. Some kind of little black and white video clip from... 1938,
right?
About silicosis, an American production.
Really?
So, in the people who are interested in this field,
let me try.
There's a wealth of information, and the British Occupational Hygiene Society, our colleagues in BOHS who do all of the asbestos qualifications and things, you know, the P401 through P405 and things like that, their origins was the National Call Board. I think it's the same with the Institute of Occupational Medicine, IOM. Again, that was National Call Board people. We're back in the DF. So the reason I get so passionate and upset, genuinely upset about this kind of thing, is there's going to be a tsunami of people who are going to die, dreadful, awful, indescribable deaths, and we've sat and let it happen. When I make the points I make, are we as good as we think we are? Where were all of us from the 90s onwards saying, excuse me, boss, this ain't right? Yeah. And the reason why this kind of perked my particular interest was, I think, around 2015 at the Thames Valley IOSH branch. Right. We had colleagues from JSP, one of the great manufacturers of safety kit in the UK, came along and demonstrated the Fred the Head demonstrator. I don't know if you've ever seen it. So they've got a headpiece inside a kind of a glass cube about a meter by a meter. And they have like a cylinder sits underneath the headpiece, which depicts the human lung with a highly polished glass. They put a mask onto the headpiece, they apply some smoke into the cube which the headpiece sits in, and they draw the plunger, which is depicting breathing in. And if the mask isn't fitting properly, then the lungs fill with smoke. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece of kit.
Wow.
That was demonstrated. And the idea behind it would be, is the right kind of press-to-test respiratory protective equipment. And one of the main selling points was around silicosis. So I'm sitting there thinking, I did this in 1974. Yes? You know, the slides. Okay, so we had them on probably one of the overhead projector type of things on a handout in 1974. I'm an old man now, Jim. So it was the same. And I'm thinking, I've seen this, you know, one of these voodoo moments. Yeah. You're getting your life. So I'm kind of, excuse me, this isn't new. This is getting on for 50 years old now.
Yeah.
And of course, the leverage for people to buy RPE, is now the new thing on the block. And we've known about this for a century.
Mm.
Yes? James, I went to five exhibitions circa 2016 through to 2019.
Yeah.
And I stopped by maybe 28 to 30 exhibition and trade stands.
Right.
That specifically dealt with either the manufacturers or suppliers or wholesalers or retailers of respiratory protective equipment.
Yeah.
And I would say, without fail, I would have left that trade stand after engaging with the people who work there, with a disagreement, even to the point of, we'll take you and beat you up. There you are. How many times has that happened to people in a safety conference, in a safety exhibition? Yes? Go away. What you're talking about doesn't sell dust masks for us.
Mm.
Yes? So my view of the world, I've been fighting dust for 50 years now.
Mm.
Think about my mining background and my father's mining background. All of my grandparents died from lung diseases from coal mining. So it's been a whole life for me.
Yeah.
What about the research and development and the creation and invention and application of kit to kill the dust at source? So you don't need to have respiratory protective equipment, but that doesn't sell dust masks, James.
Marketing is an amazing tool, right? And I run a business. I need to market. I get it.
Yeah.
But there is such... As a kind of slightly related, slightly different topic is welding fumes, right? So I've been doing a lot of work recently
with
fabricators.
Nasty stuff.
Yeah, nasty stuff, right? Welding fumes. And I had a conversation the other day, and And the guy was like, oh, well, they've got RPE. And I was like, well, yeah, they've got RPE. But there's two problems with that. One, the RPE is in a bag covered in dust, and these guys do nothing but welding every single day. So you try and tell me they're using that RPE. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's just put that to one side and forget that. As far as my interpretation of the HSE's guidance and standards of how to manage the risk of welding fume is LVE, low exhaust.
Obviously, yeah.
Try not to have the welding fumes in the first place and reduce it. That. But whatever's left, we manage with low exhaust ventilation, local exhaust ventilation, right?
Yes.
And then we have RPE. So if the fumes are so big that the air is not enough, we would then have RPE as well. Right. Mm-hmm. Or if we're, I don't know, welding in some weird place that we can't have.
Yeah, yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah.
So we
like site type of work in awkward locations.
Yeah.
Where you've got to also think, if you have to transport all of the LEV kit to a difficult to access place, you might actually increase the risk of the job.
Mm.
Yes, you know, people fall over and drop things and tip off ladders and things like that. So the whole job, and sometimes we miss those kind of things in safety.
Yeah.
And I've got a lifetime of experience of things like that. You have to use a scaffold. You have to use a scaffold. You have to use a scaffold. Okay, I've got to now carry all the component parts of the scaffold up 7 flights of stairs.
Yeah.
There's no lift to get them up in. So the risk of somebody falling over on the stairs by carrying all of the items of scaffold up 7 floors, and there's nowhere to store it up on that 7th floor, the whole job would be easy from a stepladder.
Yeah. So so in that case, so there's a great example there. So we would just go RPE, right? And the guy turned around to me and said, oh, so legislation's changed, has it? We have to, we've got to use LEV now. I was like, I'm sorry, what? He said, the legislation has changed. And I'll, for a second, it made me question myself. I was
What?
Have I missed something? So I'm like, not as far as I'm aware, mate.
Yeah.
But let me check. So I like Googled it. And I was like, no. It's kind of
always been like that, yeah.
Yeah. And he was like, oh right, wow, yeah. And anyway, then kind of interestingly, because I was saying you need to purchase LEV for these sites. It's within reason. It is fair. I kind of got an opinion with another consultant we were working with anyway. I just to triple check that I wasn't losing my mind. Yeah, all good. Right, let's get it. A couple of weeks later, did you get them? Yeah, we got them. I told the boss there was a change in legislation. So so we got it. No, there isn't a change in legislation. So, yeah. But like still now, I mean...
The
attitude towards it as well. It's just like, oh, what are you doing? Oh, are you you're working this weekend? Yeah, I'm working this weekend. What are you doing? Oh, we're just going to weld some new panels on the top of this this building. Okay, cool. Are you bringing the LEV over? It's going to be a nightmare to get the LEV in. What have you got? Are you going to use RPE? Well, you know, I haven't, I'll wear a welding mask. What, yeah, but with respiratory protection ones.
Yeah.
No, I've got, it will just kind of go straight up. It will go past me. I'm not going to breathe it in. And I was just like, wow, fucking hell.
Yeah.
Still really bad.
Well, you know,
best mates are bricky and he uses a disc cutter all the time. The last I saw, he might have changed now, I doubt it, but the last I saw him cutting some loads of shit, loads of bricks and everything, patios a lot.
Yeah.
It wasn't, there was no hose attached to it where he's kind of wet. No face covering or nothing.
Just on that point, James, in support of that point, the guru in the UK around occupational respiratory diseases is a chap by the name of Professor David Fishwick.
Right.
And if you go to the HSE's website, their lung campaign, Professor Fishwick is the main person who you see presenting in there. So his words, I think it was a 2019 conference about respiratory health. He was making a point that if you expose your workers to silica dust, they will they will get silicosis. So the point being made is, this is one of the occupational diseases you can't not get.
Right.
Yeah. So if you breathe in respirable crystalline silica, you can't not get silicosis. Now, the level of that silicosis, you know, how much it affects the working person's life, you know, and their health and their dying and their mortality before their time, will be proportional, generally speaking, to the volume, amount, and the time they've been exposed. So a tiny little bit of exposure, you'll have a tiny problem. A large amount of exposure over a long time, you're probably going to die before your time. Wow. And I think there's going to be tens and tens of thousands of people dying of silicosis over the next years. And during that 2015 presentation by our colleagues at JSP in the Thames Valley IOSH branch, there was a bullet point on the presentation. The HSE estimate is we could have as many as 10 times more people dying of silicosis than have died of all asbestos diseases combined.
Shit.
And I mean, it just blew my mind. And I'm thinking, that can't be right. It just can't be. And I actually wrote to them, and they gave me the name of the HSE person who said that. And Professor Fishweek is saying something of a similar nature. Yes?
It's Fishweek.
Yes, Fishweek. David Fishweek.
Specific.
So he is the HSE's guru for occupational respiratory diseases, and he is an NHS doctor treating people who he's got in his hospitals with occupational lung diseases. So he works, I don't know whether it's 50-50, 60-40 or something, but he's working for both organisations using his expertise on this information. After those presentations, and again, the JS people came back and said the same kind of things in 2019, I put together a montage of all the information I'd gathered and collected and sent it to BBC Panorama. Yes? Because somebody needs to get this out there. Now, one of the things I hope is going to happen here, James, is what I'm trying to say, probably badly, is completely and utterly wrong. I hope that, and I look like a bit of an idiot at the end of it. I really hope I'm completely and utterly wrong, because if I am wrong, then what we're looking at isn't going to happen. And what is going to happen probably is indescribably bad. James, it's 2022. We put men on the moon in 1969. How are we here? How did this happen?
Yeah. Yes?
You know, and can we see now why I say the things I say?
Yeah.
When this kind of evidence-based information, some of it is estimated, and in the hazards campaign they say, but the estimates are credible and reasonable and evidence-based, et cetera, et cetera. Yes? We are not in a good place. And we in Britain are supposed to be the best in the world at this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm just getting Professor Fishweek stuff ready to link for everybody. Yeah. I've also got your video, which is Stop Silicosis 1938 by the US Department of Labor.
Yeah, something like that. So what might be helpful as well, James, is I'll find that montage of information I put together to send on to BBC Panorama.
Yeah.
You know, somebody somewhere has got to tell this story to Britain about what's coming. And again, I hope I'm wrong, and I hope the reason why Panorama didn't get back to me or answer or suggest anything would be their researchers have found out that way's wrong. Yeah. But I don't think I am, you know, from what my lifetime of experience has been. But we're not in a comfortable place. And that, you know, that's on top of all the other different kinds of chemicals and dust and things which are going on. I think one of the other interesting things as well you alluded to earlier, James, is you've been a young guy and I'm an old man now. I started working in 1974, around about the same time as the Health and Safety at Work Act was introduced. And all that legislation has come through, you know, the six-pack and work at height regs and the cosh regs and lead at work and ionizing radiations and work at all them things have come along all the way through my lifetime. And you see them, you know, the reasons why they've been brought in and they've been introduced and are they effective, are they not effective, and things like that. So at the end of it, you know, that history, that life lived, those lived experiences and things, you know, gives, I hope, me a little bit of credibility to say the things I say the way I say them and, you know, try and highlight them. And the kind of difficulty would be is articulating. So the reduction in the level of deaths, you know, we'll have all seen the graphs, you know, from the 60s, 70s and 80s up when the tens of thousands of people died.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of gradually reduced down and down and down. And for the last kind of 8, 10, 12 years, we've plateaued. Sometimes it's 160, sometimes it's 120, sometimes it's 150, sometimes. So that kind of thing is just bubbling along the bottom. And Professor Dom Cooper, often, you know, says things when there's another dreadful accident comes along. So from my view of the world, coming from where I've come from, you know, before this legislation all came in, one of the main reasons why we've stopped killing so many people is not because of the Health and Safety at Work Act and not because of the Health and Safety Executive. It's because the industries that traditionally killed all the people have gone.
We've gone, yeah.
Yes. So it's not that we're particularly any better at safety. I mean, we are better at safety. There is no doubt about that, generally speaking. But the industries, the mining industry, quarrying, the shipbuilding industry, steel making, you know, those kind of big, heavy industry types of things. And of course, lots of people who are dying now of occupational diseases work in those industries. So once all of the older people who work there have died and they've gone, you know, guys my age and slightly older, the next cohort of people who are suffering dreadful is modern day legislation. So they've been protected by the legislation that came in the late 80s and the 90s. That's the next cohort of people are going to die, and it doesn't look as if it's worked.
Yeah. There is also the flip side of it. It's just like this sheer, which I've moaned about so much on the podcast, just this acceptance of 140 people on average dying every year.
I
know nobody is doing this, but it kind of feels like we're all patting ourselves on the back that, oh, it's only 140 again this year. Well done. Oh, it's 127 this year. Well done. Or is it 130 mm-hmm. this year? Well done. I'm just like,
really?
It just makes sense to me that we still, and I remember, I think one of my most unpopular posts I ever did, because obviously we put out so much content for the last 4 years, and some of it's popular, some of it's not popular, but one of the most unpopular pieces we put out was where I said something around the lines of, as a safety profession, if we all say that we exist to make sure people go home from work the same as they came in, mm-hmm. just that's a very common phrase that people say.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Every time those HSE stats come out every year, if they've not improved, we need to hold ourselves to account to say that we failed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the response I got was, no, it's not our fault. It's the MDs, it's the CEOs, blah, blah, blah. But if our job is to influence those people to make said apparently right decisions, I say it, the right in quotations, then we failed at that. Oh, no, it's just because this is out of our control. Yeah, but we can't sit here and say, I'm proud of what I do at work because I make sure people go home safe. But then when people don't go home safe, not hold ourselves accountable.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. So I want to, I know we put out, maybe IOSH put out some magazines, RRSM put out some magazines, and there is stuff going on behind the scenes, but like, it's been over a decade, mate. Like, I've been in safety over a decade.
Yeah.
And those stats have never changed. over a decade. They have never changed. And I've never once in that decade gone, now that's something I see from one of the big professional bodies or one of the big charities or one that, that I think is genuinely going to make a difference. Not one. And someone might say, oh, that's a bit harsh. We did this campaign once or whatever. But like, if I'm still going and talking to small businesses now and they haven't, they think that LEV is now a legislation change, or they've never heard of silicosis, or they still think asbestos is dealt with, it's not a problem anymore. You know, whatever it is, if I still see videos on TikTok of a guy standing on top of those old fashioned work platforms that have no edge protection, you know, like I can't remember what they call them, but like the little, not the step ups, they're quite high, like maybe a couple of meters up, a couple of planks of wood on it, off you go. Like,
trestle.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah.
I just think, you know, it's just, I don't know. Mate. I go.
But did you see that montage of photographs came into the LinkedIn feed a little while ago? I think earlier this year, with a working person on a UK construction site doing a fairly heavy duty looking piece of work. You know, with diggers and cranes and various items in flip-flops.
No, I didn't see that, no.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was like you were looking at something you might see in the developing world. And I said, no, this is Britain. This is today in Britain.
Yeah.
And it's mind-blowing
Do you not think as well, like, our focus is typically on something like that, like, everyone would go nuts for that, won't they? They'd be be wearing steel toe caps. But like, there's so many really big problems out there maiming and killing people.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we just don't talk about anywhere near enough. So, conversations I see are always, you know, oh, look, this person's leaning on a ladder. And I get that's a big risk.
Yeah, but
it's a couple of meters off the ground or on the trestle, it's on a couple of meters off the ground, but not. This geezer right on the top of the roof with no edge protection. He's wearing a high vis and a hard hat, though.
Yeah. So So it's kind of false equivalence, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the guy is working outright dangerously. The protective equipment he's got is not for the things the person's doing dangerously.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, the guy's got his hat and his glasses and his high vis on. But he's going to get squashed by a 10-ton load dropping.
Yeah.
So we've spent about 30 years getting working people into protective equipment.
Yeah.
And it's generally the first thing we reach for.
Yeah.
You know, rather than the LEV or something like that. So he would be my challenge for the next generations of safety people coming in to do what they're going to do. So the challenge would be is, how do we make work safe enough to get rid of all that protective equipment, so the work is kind of intrinsically safe. So, so that might take another 30 years. But James, who's working on that?
Yeah.
Where's IOSH? Where's IIRSM and HSW and SHP?
How could they say that, Vince, when their magazines and everything are sponsored by all of those PPE companies? That's one of their main revenue streams.
Yeah, yeah. There's three opportunities you've given me now, James, to say I rest my case, my So one of the little bullet points in the notes that we shared to start was around the agenda for safety. Particularly in the kind of G7 economies, the OECD type economies, where safety one, safety two, HOP, BBS, reliance based safety, and all of these kind of phrases, Knefin, or however it's pronounced, if I've made a mistake, Knefin. Dave Snowden, with that, my apologies.
It's Knefin. So that,
Knefin, okay. My
it's like a, it's but, like a but V that, as that well. Kind
of, that agenda, where the most senior people, the leaders, the policy makers, the influencers around the world of safety, have all got their little kind of arguments and systems and things going. In the kind of things I'm trying to articulate about the global workforce, those kind of initiatives, HOP and Safety 2 and Reliance and these kind of things, get to maybe 2, 3, 4% of the global workforce, if we're lucky.
Yeah.
And the rest of them, I don't think an unreasonable characterization for most of the working people in the global workforce is attritional survival. Yes? So there's a phrase, you know, and look at the numbers, what has us campaign and the International Labour Organization, and these type of people are putting out, you know, every year, at least 2.9 million people killed by and because of work. Yes? In the global workforce.
Yeah.
This information isn't getting there. So in its simplest form, I think six basics kind of need to overtake the conversation. Yes? Safe and healthy workers. Safe and healthy work. Safe and healthy workplace. Safe and healthy work assets. Safe and healthy work output, and safe and healthy work relationships. Mm. Yes? So all of the things all added together to come to a point. So that has to be the aspiration of safety people, of employers, of unions, of interested bodies, of the hazards campaign people, etc. For them six basic items, that's how working people should be able to go to work across the globe. And I don't think we've got that anywhere on the globe.
What about
the evidence-based facts would suggest I'm right?
Yeah, no, I think you are right. I don't think we're anywhere near it. What about those industries though that are? Can you have a health and safe and healthy work, for example, in a job that is inherently quite dangerous? So I don't know. Let's think. I don't know. RNLI. You know, they're
okay.
Go out in the middle. I'm just putting up fire service, yeah. You know.
So there will be a level of risk that's acceptable for the greater good of everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way I would try and explain to people who maybe haven't done a great deal of health and safety training, we've got this in the UK and many other parts of the world so far as is reasonably practicable.
Yes.
This kind of amorphous set of words. And yeah. Then you'll see people like puzzling and figuring and thinking, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Yes. And it can mean one thing in one industry or one workplace and something different, the same set of words.
Yeah.
So I've tried to use my company name, RSVP.
Okay.
So the risk controls, are they relevant? Are they specific? Do they bring value, and are they proportional to the hazards, risks, and dangers that you are putting your people to? And generally, there's a bit of a hallelujah, ta-da, light bulb moment. I get that, yeah. Yes?
Yeah.
The other thing as well, if we look at the definition around most of the world of health and safety of accident, we are talking about in context of working people doing work activity, in a workplace, using work assets, producing work output, and getting along together at work. Let's collectively call that work.
Yeah.
Okay, all that together. Right. Yep. So the common definition of a work accident in that context would be an unplanned, uncontrolled event that causes harm or has the potential to.
Yeah.
Most safety people around the world would understand that little phrase, that little sentence. And if there's one or two words slightly different, so in its basic form, you fall downstairs at work or you fall downstairs at home. You probably didn't plan to, and when you are bouncing arse over tit down the stairs, you're not in control.
Yeah.
So just think about that concept. So we got the phrases risk assessment, you know, method statements and things like that. So I changed the vocabulary in my organization as part of this kind of evolution into trying to get better at everything we did in planning and controlling work. So there's the word association between an accident, the unplanned and controlled event, and in order to reduce the chances, the opportunity, the probability of an unplanned and controlled event, what's the plan and how are you keeping control?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then apply RSVP in order to put something in place to either eliminate, reduce, isolate, or control those hazards, risks, and dangers. Yeah. And that was the way I came about trying to do this. And it was mind-blowing. You know, just stuff I figured out for myself through all the years of doing this, there has to be a slightly easier way. So I had the great honour of taking all the 16-year-old apprentices straight out of school, and we took them on a full week's residential health and safety induction course, a full week to start their apprenticeships in SSE and Southern Electric Contracting. And I did that for many, many years. We went from 20 apprentices to 200 apprentices. I probably had about 1,000 apprentices I've had, you know, for a full week to try to educate and coach them to get them started and some foundation in them for their health and safety at work. And there was one of the ways we actually got that kind of eureka, that light bulb. And I would say I probably stood in front of 5,000-6,000 people in my work life and said these things. It doesn't take very long. We'll do some little exercises around it. And the number of people that will come back and say, why did nobody ever explain safety like that before? You know, never heard them words, never saw it in that context, the rest of it. And when something goes wrong, when you do fall down the stairs, or you tip a tray of cups of coffee down your workmate's back, or a rocket ship decides to blow up, you know, in the middle of the atmosphere, you know, all these things happen in the world. Two questions we start with would be, what was the plan and how did you intend to keep control?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, because you've had an accident, something's happened there that you didn't expect to, you know, the unplanned and controlled event, and it's kind of worked.
Yeah.
Yeah, through that time. So my view of the world might be a bit left field, a bit slightly different than the rest of it. But the, you know, the challenges have got to be, how do we make the legislation we've got actually work? You know, what's stopping it from working?
Yeah.
Is it safety people trying to get their brownie points and their bonuses with their employers by making things look better than they actually are? Yes. You know, think about the ESG agenda, environmental, social and governance. ESG.
Yeah.
So has that new phenomena around the world become, you know, the front for telling the corporate story that we want out to the world? But behind the scenes there, all this destruction and death and pestilence and diseases going on.
Well, that's, I mean, there is, I don't know if I want to say this, actually. there's so much going on in the world that is, it's just massive, and that all need to be, it all needs to be done, right? You know, it's talking about sending women up to the moon, and that should definitely happen, right? We should put a woman on the moon. Yeah. We really should do that, right? We should have women in NASA and be, you know, just to have one woman in the room when we sent a man to the moon was just shocking. I've got a daughter and I just think, God, I want a better world for.
Yeah, of course. Women, yeah. Right?
There, we're talking about, I don't know. I'm trying to think of other examples of whether we're trying to solve problems that sometimes I think we seem to have gone in our head, like, yep, like sustainability is another example, right? We're trying to solve all of these problems with, like, the cost of living crisis. It's huge right now. There's a massive Our energy bills have, what, tripled over a matter of a couple of months. They're probably going to triple again. It's such a huge problem.
Yeah.
I just think we're not really talking about, like, the root cause of a lot of these problems.
Yeah.
I think safety is very much the same. So we would take ESG as your example, right? We're still not talking about the root cause of these problems.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's just because the economy is not, it's not designed. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm saying it out loud, James. It's profit at any cost runs the world.
Yeah.
So, and I would go so far as to say, and again, there might be people scream, you know, and it causes a wealth of kind of negative comments here. The volume of people, the numbers of people who are killed, injured, disabled, maimed, poisoned, victimized, exploited in the global workforce, it has to be obscenely profitable to harm working people. It has to be.
Yeah.
The fiduciary duty, you know, and the governance of the board of directors of most of the corporations and businesses in the world is the delivery of return and profit to the owners, the beneficial owners, the shareholders of the organization, and they are usually remunerated as a result of that profit performance. Yeah.
Yeah.
And quite simply, if it costs less to care than kill, people will be looked after.
Mm.
If it costs less to kill than care, I'm sorry, you're going to die.
Yeah.
I don't think it's any more complicated than that. And by the fact so many people are dying as a result of the work they've done, according to the facts and the information, the rest of it, it has to be obscenely profitable to kill people at work across the world.
And you can use, again, the diversity case to back that up in the fact that, you know, the majority, that's, well, last I was told from the research done by Lorenzo Vicente, I think his name is, if I remember rightly, all medicines are tested on men, not women, because women's bodies are too kind of active with the menstrual cycle and stuff too much, whereas men's bodies are and our states are biochemical states are quite stable, whereas women are not with the menstrual cycle. So we don't test on women because it's not profitable to test on women because it would take too long and actually no drug is likely to pass because the results would be too...
Oh, I wasn't aware of any of that,
Where most PPE doesn't fit the female body, so you have... Where you have stab vests that a lot of women are known to take off, bulletproof vests as well, but to take off the plate in the front because it hurts so much.
So
it would cost too much money for us to mold a bulletproof vest to the shape of a female body. The list literally goes on.
It's
painfully scary to listen to. I'm again, just to kind of make my point very clear, is when I say, like, when I use putting a woman on the moon as an example, what I'm saying is we should 100% put a woman on the room on the moon. However, we're not even giving women drugs that have been tested on women. We're not even giving women PPE that is designed for women.
Well,
I'm just like, I mean, there's things we could be focusing on here.
It's only just over half of the population of Earth.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just like, we're not even like fair, safe and healthy. Mm-hmm. It's a normal everyday work that we do all the time. And the conversations I hear the majority of media having, I'm just like... Mate, we're still killing a shitload of people a year. We're still forcing women to wear stuff that just doesn't work. Like, the list just goes on, and it's scary. When you, Vince, came across the Hazard campaign and those figures, did you have like a glass smash moment? I know you touched on it when you said about the silicosis example. Was that the first time where you thought, shit, we're not really as good as what we think we are? Or was it gradual? Was there like a glass?
In all my work life, you know, the education I've done and getting into safety, there'd always been a kind of a concern and a worry and a thought and something I've articulated as we alluded to at the start of the podcast, you know, that person with a bit of bravery to say, excuse me, we need to look over there. So that's always been in me.
Been natural.
The you know, curiosity and dig into something and try to find out and think, oh my word, I didn't quite expect to see that. That's not what the headlines say. That, you know, that's not what the common knowledge of this information is. Mm. When you get down to the hazards campaign, you know, for me it was like, well, I suspect these kind of things, but then it puts into kind of stark contrast.
Mm.
So here's some evidence-based fact and some credible and reasonable level of estimates, you know, done by credible, reasonable people, you know, with knowledge of the subject, is presented to you, and it's, you know, worse than what I thought, and there's the evidence I've been looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in looking at like why is the world the way it is?
Yeah.
You know, with these kind of international trade agreements, where if a sovereign country's government asks a big corporation to stop spewing toxics into their rivers because they've run out of clean water that's fit for human beings, and the big global corporation says, well, we now need to build a treatment plant that's going to cost us $150 million. So you signed a trade agreement with us. So now the taxpayers of your country have to pay for our...
the shit.
And people look and think, no, that doesn't happen. Well, James, yes, it does. Yes, you know, Ecuador and all the stuff what happened around the Amazon, you know, with the oil spills and things, and, you know, you have to clean this up.
Well, I think as well, people think it's places like it's the third world parts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No.
Whereas you can go watch a documentary on Flint. I think it's Flint City in America.
Yeah, in Michigan. Water
was just, well, it just Google Flint City, people.
Yeah, yeah. It's mid USA.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's not. Yeah. Flint is mid USA. Yeah, you just think it is. If you, the more you get into this, the more you start to think it is profit over people, 100%. Yeah,
yeah. Well,
I'm all for profit. You know, I run a company myself. I want to make profit, 100%.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But I don't want to – somebody asked me the other day, like, Jane, like, kind of what's your desire for the company? And I was like, don't get me wrong, I want Risk Fluent to be huge and I want to be unbelievably successful. I come from a very poor background and I literally fear being poor. Yeah. However, I do not want to lay in my deathbed and be like, I'm rich, but be slightly questionable as to how I got there. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a, but, and that's why I love that kind of a story that I used before with Jane from the World of Work podcast, is that some things are business case and some things are moral case. And we weigh up the two all the time. Not everything is a business case, which that's why I really love something like that.
The point would be is the beneficial owners of most of the corporations in the world, if there's a balance between the business case that will turn profit and a moral case that would reduce their profits, the business case for profits will win the argument.
Yeah.
If, however, the negative press and negative information would be so damaging to that organization's reputation, they have to do it. There's the leverage you need.
Mm.
But then you get an ESG person to come and tell the right story.
Mm.
Put the right information out, cherry pick all the good stuff. Yes. Yeah. And the ESG people out there, you'll be all screaming, I guess, no, that's not what we do. I think we'll find the evidence and the facts would be contrary to that.
You know, in like the ESG world, the environment world, sustainability world, you have the kind of phenomenon, I suppose, called greenwashing. Have you heard that?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So where a company says, we plant 100 trees, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, all that good actually, stuff, yeah.
Actually, they're spewing shit.
Well, actually, bad stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're spewing shit into rivers and
blah, blah, blah,
blah, right? Yeah. This is the first time I've said this on the podcast, and I've been thinking about it a while. I think there's such a thing, and I think it happens right now in safe washing. Yes. I think that we are safe washing in these companies that are like, we've just won, and I've worked for one of them. We've got a Rotspur Gold Award. We've got ISO 14,000, 9,000, 45,000. This award, we've won Rotspur Gold Award 20 million times in the last 5 years or whatever. But actually, when I'm working in the company behind the scenes, it's a shitstorm and we don't give a crap about people. And we were genuinely really seriously hurting people. And
you realize, James, when this podcast goes out, we're about as popular as a fart in a spacesuit.
But at least I can lay in my deadbed, mate, and fit.
Say it the way it is. And yes, you know, I've won, you know, my personal work. In the early 2000s, we won the Industry Sector Award in Rotspur. One of the top awards, and may have even been a finalist for the George Earl Trophy.
Right.
The very top one. Yeah, so all the industries go together. And I think the year it was maybe Kellogg's or something like that won. We were just a little organisation at the time.
Yeah.
Yes. I don't think we'd even put the nail in the wall in order to hang the certificate on. And we had the first guy dead.
Mm.
Yep.
I think...
And it's like, I mean, it's a stab in the heart. You know, all the stuff you've tried and you've checked and you've double-checked and you've treble-checked and you've looked and looked and looked. And then somewhere around there, somebody's kind of sneaking around doing some stuff that shouldn't be. The management haven't caught up with it, or they have, and they've turned a blind eye. And a young man, age 28... is killed at his work and leaves two kids behind under 5 years of age.
Yeah.
And we've got the phone on the desk of the MD waiting for the widow to phone the husband. We had no contacts or anything like this for the person to ring and say, where are you? And we had to answer the phone to say, he ain't coming home.
Yeah.
I've done all that, James. I've picked the body parts up and the rest. And do you know what? It's a bit tiresome.
Yeah,
it is a bit tiresome, and still the same arguments and still the same fights and the rest of it. And what you're doing here is wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah, but really, to try to kind of highlight and get people to look, and you know you're going to have people push back. You know there might be some negative comments and the rest of it, but the facts of the matter. Mm. Yes, you know. Look at this with a kind of forensic lens. We are not very good at this. No. We are not very good at this. No. Yes. And I think your safety washing comparison with greenwashing and sports washing and reputation laundering and those phrases, what's going around the world now. Yep. I think you've hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You heard it here first. Copyright. Yes. Mm-hmm. I need to write a book.
Okay. Yeah, good man. Mm-hmm.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say. And it is, you're very right. I can relate to kind of what you've said a couple of times, in that this doesn't make you popular. Rebrand is, a lot of people come to me and say, oh, it must be awesome being doing rebrand and safety. I've actually struggled to get jobs, not been able to get asked to take the podcast down by three of the major recruiting specialists in safety recruitment agencies asked me to come temporarily bring down Rebrand and Safety and so on. Yeah. And I said, no, there's a reason why I was self-employed. Maybe we weren't employable.
well, I'm self-employed now. I mean, I'm now in my third generation of work.
Yeah.
So 20 years deep mining,
you
know, hard, grinding, physical, struggling, dangerous, horrible work that I'm suffering badly for now. Yeah. My body is broken. I've been in hospital in a couple of weeks' time when I'm in. That will be the 27th time I'll have been in hospital to have something fairly significant done in the last 10 years, 27 times. And it's all body parts breaking down, 16 spine operations and interventions and stuff like that, and a host of other stuff. But I enjoyed my work.
Yeah.
Really thoroughly enjoyed my work and got a great deal from it. Then another 20 years in SSE, doing contracting and the main business there. Again, a wonderful breadth of experiences and activities and initiatives. And I mean, absolutely fantastic. And then from 2014 onwards self-employed. So I'm now working with a group of people generally around their kind of mid-20s up to about 40. I mean, kind of two generations after me, and trying to make a positive contribution to keep that group of people safe.
Yeah.
And they are putting stuff in space that's never been done in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, putting technology on the International Space Station, sending stuff up to Mars. And I mean, it's mind blowing.
Yeah.
So I've come from a half mile underground up to outer space.
Yeah.
It's out of this world, James. Absolutely out of this world. And I bet there's not many safety people can say that. And I've done most bits in between as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a mate.
I've done all right. But till I'm on that deathbed, I will keep saying what I say and doing what I do, yeah, and trying to get the world a better place for working people.
Yeah, like that, mate. Well, on that note, I'm going to have to wrap this up because I've got another interview, mate. So thank you very much for coming on.
It's a pleasure, James, and thanks for asking me. And I hope you get a lot from this, and the listeners and viewers do. And you heard it first. Safety washing from James McPherson. Goodbye.
We will. I'll put the silicosis video, which I'm going to watch after this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put that in the description. I'll put the Hazard campaign in the description as well. I'll put your LinkedIn in the description. People want to connect with you. And anything else you want to give a shout out to?
It was just I will send to you that montage of information I put together that I sent into the Panorama BBC to try to get the silicosis issue highlighted. Yeah. And there might be some resources in there you could share.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Okay. We can give that to the audience.
Thanks, James. You take care. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay happy. And best wishes for Risk Fluent and all you do.
Thank you, mate. Okay, peeps, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Vince. If you did, try and think of one person you can share it with. Maybe it's a colleague that you think, you know what, I've been telling you for years, we need to do better, and this is why. So maybe share that. Maybe it's a boss that goes, we didn't think about this. Maybe we should start doing better. Maybe we need to be better. Maybe you can use this to help you as a kind of evidence towards the next project that you're trying to get across the line, or the budget you're trying to get approval from. Just think of one person you could share this episode with. If you enjoyed it and you're not subscribed, hit subscribe, hit follow, blah, blah, blah. If you want to help us out, Risk Fluent and Rebranding Safety, you can go and buy yourself some merch on our website, www.riskfluentltd.com. Or if you need some help with this stuff, then we are a consultancy as well, so you can go and check that out. We provide everything from technical, normal health and safety all the way up to kind of human organization. Organizational performance, behavioral change, culture change type stuff, whatever you want to call it. If you want to find out some more, go to www.riskfluentltd.com, or you can email me, james@riskfluentltd.com. Otherwise, I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.